morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Jude Redwood. I represent the plaintiff in this cause of action, Keith Gower. This is a case involving the Fourth Amendment and the First Amendment. Basically, the two issues are whether there was probable cause to arrest Mr. Gower for disorderly conduct, and the second issue is whether the arrest of Gower from his home violated the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment is one of the amendments that we hold the most dear. Mr. Gower was in his house in the early hours, and there was a complaint. It's a very fact-specific case. However, I believe that the case of Welsh versus Wisconsin is cited in my brief. If not on all fours, does speak directly to the incidents in this case. We have an individual who the police are wanting to arrest for disorderly conduct. And in Welsh, of course, it was a DUI offense where the guy had driven off the road. In this case, it was disorderly conduct, and the conduct that the officers were concluding was disorderly conduct.
The law is pretty clear, though, isn't it?
Which law?
On disorderly conduct in Illinois, you brandish a knife and you conduct yourself with that language.
There was no knife brandished on the morning that the officer...
The evening before, when the complaint was filed.
On the evening before, there was testimony that there was a knife. There was unclear testimony whether the officers on the morning of February 12th knew that the knife had been brandished.
The lack of clarity was about how Officer Verclear learned about the knife the night before, not whether he was aware of that at the time he was approaching the house. You know, I have to tell you, if you were arguing to the jury, I would understand the arguments you're making, but it seems to me the jury resolved many of these key points against you. For instance, who let the officers into the house? Was it the child or was it Mr. Gower? The jury believes that it was Mr. Gower. Maybe it could have believed the other, but once the jury has believed something, that's pretty much the end of the discussion. And the same thing is true about the disorderly conduct. Statute is not a perfect map of Chaplinsky fighting words, just a totality of the circumstances statute in Illinois, as in most states. And once again, the jury finds that in the totality of the circumstances, the officers had enough to go on. So it's a hard appeal to ask us to disagree with the jury's determination.
Your Honor, I would agree with the court that disagreeing with the jury's decision on the consent issue is probably my most uphill battle, that I'm asking you to find that no rational jury could find that based on the facts and the circumstances in this particular case, because the consent does not only have to be consent, it has to be both a valid and a knowing consent. And
but if you believe the officer's testimony and you read through the transcript, obviously I wasn't sitting there, but I can read the transcript, the officers testify that Mr. Gower says, come in, or whatever. I mean, the words to the effect of they hear him, they know him, and they go in. If the jury believes that, then what's left?
What's left is in order to arrest Mr. Gower, there also must be probable cause to arrest him from within his home, from anywhere.
But there's nothing left in terms of the entry into the home. The entry into the home is fine if he consents to the entry into the home.
Your Honor, I don't believe that there was a voluntary and knowing consent given the facts that were given to the jury, and I believe that no rational jury could have found that there was a valid and voluntary consent. But I would like to address
Why don't you move on to the other point?
The issue of disorderly conduct. In Illinois and in fact in the federal courts, words alone cannot be disorderly conduct except in very carefully circumscribed cases, such as are listed in the brief, and in this particular case, it has to be fighting words. Now,
why does it have to be fighting words, though, in the context where there's been all this history between these people, where the officer knows that the woman's very upset that morning, that there's been the knife incident the night before? That adds meaning to the words beyond just on the face what those words might connote to you.
there has to be some kind of a threat, because the First Amendment is so important. We've got the right to hate each other. We've got the right to call each other bad names or dirty names. And because of the very valuable rights protected by the First Amendment, we can't go arresting people because they're saying something that maybe everybody else would disagree with. But it isn't a threat. It doesn't rise to the level of a crime. We're allowed to say what we think.
But
and
that's not that alone. You're forgetting the incident the evening before.
The incident...
He brandished a knife. And on that, the complaint was made.
The incident of the evening before was shown to the jury that the knife was not actually brandished, that it was held behind the door. But if we want to start taking every aspect of a person's life, everything that's occurred within months of the incident of the arrest, then what we're asking to do is have a continuing tort theory for arrests. We can't have that. The surrounding
circumstances. And as Judge Wood pointed out, it's the totality of the circumstances.
I agree. The totality of the circumstances, Your Honor, were it was 6 o'clock in the morning. The two houses were 70 yards apart. There was not a face-to-face confrontation between anybody. One person stuck his head out the door and said, I called the cat, I said, kitty, kitty. Another person who was 70 yards away, and who these people have this antagonistic feeling toward each other, testified that he heard the usual thing.
But you conveniently forgot the incident the evening before in your recitation of facts.
The incident of the evening before is in the recitation of facts, however.
It's all part of the same circumstances.
What the officer testified is that he knew that there had been an incident the evening before. Neither of the parties testified that they told him about a knife the day before. He knew about the knife later on, but when he came up there, he didn't know about the knife. He couldn't say, you know, how did he know about the knife? And indeed, both of the complaining witnesses stated under oath that they hadn't told him anything about a knife the day before. So what we have to do is look at the circumstances as the officer saw them at that moment in time, not as he later investigated, then wrote in his report, and then even later went to deposition, and then even later went to court and testified to enlarge his story. The incident about the knife, the testimony in the trial shows, there's no clear testimony at all that he knew about the incident about the knife the day before.
Just a pure credibility issue, and the jury found so.
Even if there was an incident of a knife before, I don't think that's the turning point at all. I think it's the nature of the words that are spoken on the day that they were spoken. The day that the words were spoken were pure insults. They weren't nice words, if indeed that's what he said. And of course, that's disputed, but the jury found that he did say those words. Even if he did say those words, the dirty words, as they call them, there was no threat inherent. And the Illinois Court of Appeals for the 4th District in People v. Redwood found that there must be some kind of implied or explicit threat in order for words to rise to disorderly conduct. We're talking about arresting an individual, forcing him into court, forcing him to hire an attorney or get an attorney and defend himself, and for what? For words. That is why the Supreme Court of the United States in Lewis stated emphatically that the words have to be fighting words. And if you look through the cases, fighting words always include some kind of threat at the time that they were stated. Now, they arrested him for probable cause. What could they have done is they could have went and got a warrant. They could have sat there if they thought that the situation was so horrendous. They had two officers there with two cars, and went to a neutral and detached magistrate and placed that before the court, which is what they should have done.
How many officers have been into that location in the last several days preceding the incident?
There were believed two officers there the day before.
And before that there were?
And two the morning of the incident that we're talking about. So four totally in the last 2 days.
But the other two were individually, came out individually, right?
In
other words, there had been a number of calls and a number of officers that had come to that location.
That is correct. The evidence showed that the father-in-law continually called the 911 number when he and the son-in-law were arguing.
Or he felt threatened.
I don't think there was any finding that he felt threatened. It's our position that he abused the 911 line by repeatedly calling for argument, but it was both of their habit to argue with each other. And under the First Amendment, they're allowed to argue with each other. They're allowed to stand on the other side of the fence and yell at each other, obscenities, or call each other dirty names if we want. It's the First Amendment.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you.
May it please the court and counsel, I'm Jerome Wright. I'm the attorney for the defendant's appellees. And I believe it is really a common sense notion that the surrounding circumstances should be looked at. It's recognized in the case law, but I believe it's also common sense. If, in The Honeymooners, if Ralph Brandon says to Ed Norton, I'll kill you, or to the moon, Alice, people laugh. But if a mob enforcer says to a stool pigeon, I'll kill you, it's an entirely different situation. This is recognized in the Davis case, which I cite in my brief, where Davis, his a complaint was lodged against his brother, and he said to the person who lodged the complaint words to the effect of, I hope he doesn't go to jail. If you do, well, Ms. Pearl, you know me. And the court pointed out that those words in and of themselves aren't threatening, but in the context of the victim, the alleged victim, having made this complaint, sworn out this complaint against his brother, that under those circumstances it was disorderly conduct, it was threatening. And, of course, we have that here. And, of course, it's, the arrest was based on the information that the deputies had. Deputies were made aware coming over when they got the call that there had been an incident the night before.
I wonder if we could pause on that for just a minute, because your opponent has said that while they were aware that there was an incident the night before, they did not have an awareness of the details of that incident, particularly the knife, that there was some violence or potential violence associated with it. Is that correct? What did they know?
No, the evidence that was presented is what they knew before they arrived at the scene was the one deputy was had been called out to a previous altercation, a previous run-in between the plaintiff and the in-laws. When being called to the scene, Metcad informed the deputy that there had in fact been an incident between the plaintiff and the in-laws the night before. When the deputy conducted his investigation at the scene, talking to the in-laws and talking to the one who had departed to go to work on his cell phone, he was made aware that there was this, allegedly, of course this is the information given to him, that there was this incident the night before where the plaintiff brandished the knife at the in-laws, and the deputies were called out, and the father-in-law went back home, and that was that.
So, but your position is, when you look at the record, we'll see that the jury had before it testimony from which it could have believed that before he walks up to the door and knocks on it, he knows that much about the prior.
He knows about the branching.
Yes. And the cases say that there's disorderly conduct not only where there's an explicit or implied threat. The plaintiff recognizes in his brief, there's the Albert case where there's the intoxicated lady screaming in the dead of night outside in a residential neighborhood. It was described in the plaintiff's reply brief that disorderly conduct statute under those circumstances is a reasonable time, place, and manner restriction. And in the Allen case, which is cited in our brief, where they're defining a breach of the peace, a breach of the peace includes not only violent acts, but acts likely to produce violence in others. And it's our contention that the in-laws, certainly it would be reasonable to think that they may have felt threatened, again, based on all the circumstances, based on what happened the night before. The night before ended it with the incident with a knife, and now here he comes out here and he's screaming obscenities and he's making gestures. What's going to happen now?
So you would, would you agree that if it was nothing but those words in isolation that you need something more for disorderly conduct?
I would think so, yes.
But by the time you see, so you don't see this as a mere words, quote unquote, case?
No, it is not at all a mere words case. And in addition, if you look at what they talk about, acts likely to produce violence in others, I think that's definitely what we have here. When you look at what is this clucking like a chicken about? Well, what the clucking like a chicken is about is he's screaming the obscenities at the father-in-law. Well, first off, after he brandished the knife, the father-in-law went home the night before. Now he's screaming the obscenities as the father-in-law is getting in his truck to go to work. And what does he do? He keeps proceeding to his truck to drive off. So the clucking like a chicken is he's calling him a chicken, which can certainly, again, in the context here, produce a violent reaction, and the father-in-law certainly could have ended up running over there. Before you know it, there's a physical violence going on here. So, I think that again, you have to look at the surrounding circumstances, and with that, what is the standard here? It was on a motion for a directed verdict, and we have to find whether or not there was evidence such that the jury could properly find for the non-moving party. And I think there was certainly sufficient evidence where the jury could believe that the in-laws felt threatened, and that certainly, based on the context, this behavior on the part of the plaintiff could have produced a violent reaction, and there certainly would have been a breach of the peace. Breach of the peace doesn't have to be violent, but a breach of the peace turning into a violent breach of the peace. With regard to the Fourth Amendment issue, we have a mixed question of law and fact, and the standard there is whether it was clear error by the jury, and I don't see how, by any stretch of the imagination, the jury's finding based on the evidence that there was consent to entry could be called clear error. We're not arguing exigent circumstances, we're not arguing we're not claiming that the child was the one who allowed the entry, and that sufficient consent to get that from a child. What we're claiming, and what the evidence was to the jury, is that the deputy had contact with this fellow before to know that this is Keith, and he called in Keith, identified himself, Deputy Berkler, can I come in? And the response back was yes. It was an affirmative verbal response. And so I certainly think it was enough for the jury to find that there was consent.
So just for the record, I think that your assertion that clear error review ever applies to jury verdicts is a bit questionable in light of the Seventh Amendment, but
the court defined that, clear error for the court.
Against the great weight of the evidence, perhaps, if we're looking at that at most. I understand your basic point, but I just wanted to comment.
Do your honors have any questions?
No.
Thank you.
All right. Anytime. Court will take the case under advisement. Proceed to case number 4.